Thank you all for joining. My name is Dan Huff. I am the director of the Middle East Forum's Legal Project. We are dedicated to defending the free speech rights of authors and activists who comment on radical Islam. And when I say defend their rights, I think three challenges. The first is you have to defend their free speech rights against physical threats. We saw that very recently with Molly Norris, the Seattle cartoonist. Many of you may have heard she was forced into hiding, ordered into hiding by the FBI, after her name was placed on a hit list of radical Muslims because she had produced a cartoon that depicted Muhammad and suggested others do the same. So there's the physical threats that you have to contend with. And there are also legal threats. People who discuss issues related to radical Islam can be prosecuted for hate speech. This happens mostly in Europe. You have the case of Geert Wilders, the prominent speaker, the prominent politician there, who's now being standing in the docket under prosecution for hate crimes, and it's been going on for a year and a half now, or 2 years, and it's causing a great distraction to him and costing a great deal of money. You also have prosecutions for violation of civil rights. You can have civil lawsuits for libel, also for violations of civil rights. And so you have these physical threats, you have legal threats. And the third category of threat that we try to worry about here at the Legal Project is what we call socioeconomic threats. So people are threatened that if they say certain things or don't stop saying particular things, they may lose their jobs. That happened most recently to Juan Williams, the commentator for NPR. So we track these three different types of threats, and we try to intervene to aid people to ensure that the discussion of radical Islam is wide open and robust and thoughtful. And we do this essentially by operating at two levels. We operate at a case level where we'll provide legal and financial aid to people who've been sued or otherwise persecuted for speaking out. So, for example, I mentioned Wilders. Well, he's actually a client of ours. We provide substantial financial aid to his case to ensure he's able to continue doing what he wants to do, and he's not intimidated by these efforts to silence him through the law. We also work at a policy level to publicize a threat and devise solutions. And it's really this latter area of our focus that's going to be the focus of the discussion today. We only have limited time, so I'm just going to focus on one particular threat that we're trying to publicize and then one particular solution we're trying to publicize. And I'll try to do it briefly to leave substantial time for questions. If there aren't any, we can proceed with some further details. But this is the basic outline of one threat and one solution. So first, the threat. The threat that I want to bring to your attention is the effort by Islamic countries at the UN to ban defamation of Islam. Now, when I say Islamic countries at the UN, I refer to the Organization of the Islamic Conference. This is a group of essentially 57 Islamic countries, major Islamic countries. They are majority Islamic, in some cases entirely Islamic, and they cooperate on various political, economic, social issues, and they vote typically as a bloc at the UN. So they're really quite powerful. And what they're trying to do essentially is to replicate their own domestic repressive blasphemy laws at the international level and say that not only should do they apply domestically within our own borders, but they should apply broadly to the society at large, because it's not right to criticize Islam, to criticize religions. Now, this is not a new effort, and I'll explain shortly why we need to be worried about it now. But they essentially started this in 1999. And what they did was they sponsored a resolution, and they called it defamation of Islam, and they wanted to prohibit defamation of Islam. They don't really define the term, but to give you an example of the sort of things they consider defamation, there was a discussion in front of the Human Rights Council in 2007 of the problem of female genital mutilation, and it was suggested by a representative of a certain organization, of a non-governmental organization, an NGO, that it was sanctioned, that the practice was sanctioned in Islamic law, or that to the extent that it wasn't sanctioned by Islamic law, that ought to be clarified by various Muslim leaders in the various countries. Well, this enraged the representatives from Pakistan and Egypt, and they demanded that the discussion cease and that further discussions of Islam be banned within the council, in-depth discussion. So they consider that an insult to Islam. They consider that a defamation. So the sort of things that you and I might consider legitimate discourse to them were beyond the pale. Another example, Pakistan blocked access to the website of Richard Dawkins, who's a prominent evolutionary biologist, after there were complaints that he was essentially defaming Islam and committing blasphemy. So again, what they have, what they envision here within defamation of Islam is the sort of legitimate discussion that most people in Western democracies would want to be able to have. And so it's a very dangerous idea that they are putting forth. But what they've been doing is essentially putting together a resolution and offering it annually. Every year they offer it up both in the Human Rights Council, and they try to move it to the General Assembly, which is the main body at the UN, and get it passed. And it doesn't have binding effect yet, but they're trying to lay the groundwork for an eventual binding treaty. Now, we know that they really want to focus on Islam, even though they couch it more broadly, because the original resolution was focused on banning defamation of Islam. But they were subsequently advised that this was not sufficiently egalitarian to garner any support, so they changed it from defamation of Islam to defamation of religions. So you may hear now about defamation of religions, but what they really refer to is defamation of Islam and insulting Islam, and as I say, this encompasses a very broad category of items. Now, the reason we need to worry about that today is because the U.S. has recently shifted tactics. At one point, the United States essentially did not support this at all. But you have the current administration is eager to curry favor with the Islamic world, and therefore it has essentially shifted its position and removed the traditional opposition. So they haven't embraced it wholeheartedly, but they indicate that there is room for negotiation on this, and that's what I think is actually very, very critical and very disturbing about the current situation. So it began in September 2009 when the United States with Egypt offered a joint resolution which condemned negative stereotypes about Islam, about religion, and said that member states should essentially take efforts to make sure that, particularly in the media, negative stereotypes were not promoted. And this is sounds like a very... it's somewhat offensive, I guess, to people who are used to broad free speech protections in the United States. The idea that the government should tell the media that they should what they should or shouldn't say, it's very troubling. And it actually reminds us now of what happened to Juan Williams, that it was felt that he was perpetuating a negative stereotype by talking about the fact that he felt uncomfortable on airplanes when he saw people in traditional Muslim garb, even though his point was that this stereotype ought to be overcome and not heeded. But the fact that he even mentioned it, he was fired for, and it would seem that perhaps you already see the fruits of this resolution that the United States and Egypt offered in 2009. But the point is that's already a step in the direction of censoring speech that's deemed offensive to Islam. And it's rather unfortunate that the United States has agreed to it. Now, if you talk to U.S. representatives about it, they'll tell you that, well, you know, the language is very broad and the United States is not bound and it's just a resolution, and so therefore everything is okay. And that brings us to really what's the crux of the point that we're trying to make at the Legal Project, which is that the First Amendment provides a false sense of security. There's an idea, I think, popularly and in government as well, that essentially we can sign on to any type of instrument at the international level that says, oh, people ought to be very careful about what they say and not insult Islam or not insult religion, because ultimately that will never be enforced within the U.S. borders. And how do we know this? Because we have this First Amendment that would prevent it. And indeed, you have in various binding treaties, I was referring earlier to resolutions, but there are binding treaties as well. For example, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, that contains a provision essentially saying that there should be a ban on incitement to hatred and incitement to discrimination. Now, in the United States, incitement can be made a crime, but only if it's incitement to imminent lawless action. Go commit a crime and, you know, kill X right now, and that incitement is likely to produce it. So it's very, very narrow and limited in the U.S., and it's only limited to incitement to violence, whereas in this convention, and you have incitement to discrimination or incitement to hostility, and these are very vague terms which essentially approach hate speech. Now, the U.S. signed on to this, but it avoided application by saying that, well, we have a reservation to this treaty. We have an exception where we're not going to enforce this to the extent it would force us to do something which is contrary to the First Amendment. And the thought is, again, well, we have the First Amendment, and it will protect us. And the point that we're trying to make here is not so fast. And the reason I say that is because if you actually examine First Amendment jurisprudence, the way that courts analyze the First Amendment, what they say is that generally the First Amendment protects speech, but the First Amendment can be trumped by what they call a compelling government interest. In other words, if the government has a very compelling case for halting speech in a particular situation, then that may trump the First Amendment right. So for you might think, for example, of state secrets, something that's very, very important. They can, you know, ban you from revealing top secrets. And it's done on the ground that, well, there's a compelling interest, and that trumps the general right to free speech. And the problem you have here is that complying with international law could be deemed such a compelling interest. And if complying with international law is a compelling interest, then you could say, well, we have to limit speech because we have this resolution that says we should, or we have this treaty that says we should, and that's a compelling interest, and therefore that trumps whatever First Amendment protections you might otherwise have. And so you have essentially a backdoor means of suppressing speech that you would not be able to do domestically by bringing in international law. Now, you'll probably say to me that this sounds very fantastic and is not likely to happen, but our insight is it already has. This has actually already occurred. In 1984, actually I think it was 1986, there was a case that came up to the D.C. Circuit, which is a fairly conservative circuit. There were conservative judges at the time. Robert Bork was one of them. And the case at issue concerned a law in the District of Columbia in D.C. which banned the display of critical messages within 500 feet of an embassy. So you couldn't hold up a sign that criticized a particular government within 500 feet of its embassy, which seems to implicate core constitutional First Amendment rights to discuss political matters. And the law was justified on the grounds that, well, there's an international law, an international treaty, the Vienna Convention, to which the U.S. is a party. And this convention requires signatories to protect embassies from, quote, impairments to their dignity. And this was a way of preventing impairments to the embassy's dignity by saying that you can't hold up signs that may call them into question, call their policies into question, otherwise insult or criticize them within 500 feet of these embassies. And it was challenged on First Amendment grounds. And the D.C. Circuit upheld the law against the First Amendment challenge. Why? Because they said there's a compelling interest in following international law and complying with international law, here the Vienna Convention, and therefore that trumps what would ordinarily be your First Amendment right to hold up a sign in front of an embassy. So you already have this problem occurring. Now, the case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed it, but it reversed on separate grounds. It didn't address the question of the to what extent we would let a compelling interest in international law trump the First Amendment. So you already have that in the jurisprudence, and it would seem now that it could be turned on us to essentially allow a backdoor means of bringing in essentially hate speech laws that prevent serious open discussion of the threat posed by radical Islam. So we've written some articles on that in Fox News and other areas, and we're hoping to bring people's attention to it, because I think a lot of times people think, again, that this First Amendment will protect us, or they think, well, it won't protect us, but because you have activist judges or people who are going to try to impose their own ideas, and what they don't realize is that there are conservative judges, there is actual legal, technical reasons why this could happen without sort of a break from the traditional First Amendment analysis that exists. So it's a much more significant threat than I think people realize. I was actually at a talk some months ago, and a prominent analyst from Wall Street Journal was there, and he said that, well, we're discussing threats to free speech rights, but really these threats don't exist, or they're not so strong, and he cited the case of the marchers in Nazi Party essentially marching in Skokie as a famous case from years ago when the Supreme Court allowed it, and he said that, you know, if we're going to go that far to allow that, then we don't have to worry about this, but it's not so, because that was involved in domestic law, and I talk now about international law, and there is a way, as I say, to get it in through the back door. So that's a major issue that we're trying to bring people's attention and make them realize, wake up, this is much more serious than perhaps you realize for the reasons we set forth. So that is an example of publicizing the threat. The other thing I said we do is we devise solutions. A lot of times people talk and say A, X, Y, and Z is bad, but they don't provide any way of addressing the problem. So we do. And what we've come up with, and this is a solution to the broader problem of threats of physical violence. So we're not focused now on legal threats against speech, but physical threats against speech. As I said, Molly Norris, or people who've been forced into hiding, the cartoonists from Denmark and so forth. There's many, many cases. It began with Salman Rushdie back in 1989. But you have the major choice of the Islamists is to use physical violence against their enemies and say, you know, quit talking or you may wind up dead. And they mean it. And our solution was, well, what we notice, our insight is, that in the 1990s, abortion providers faced the same sort of threats from extremists that authors and cartoonists face now. and therefore the same federal law that Congress passed then to defend them could, with only minor modifications, be used to protect the authors and the cartoonists. Excuse me. The law I refer to is the 1994 Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, and it passed by solid bipartisan margins in both houses. And what it does is it says it's a federal crime to threaten anyone trying to exercise abortion rights. So that means either a doctor who's providing them or a patient who is soliciting them. And if you are threatened, it provides not only is it a crime, but victims can sue for damages in civil court. They can obtain damages against the person who made the threat. And the third thing that can happen is that the attorney general can sue for an injunction, can get a court to order individuals or organizations to stop behavior that violates the law. So it's a powerful law. It gives a great deal of attention to the matter at the federal level and brings to bear the federal government's enforcement apparatus, and most importantly, in our view, permits victims to sue for damages. And that's important because a lot of times you may have reasons of political correctness or other types of things where they don't want to bring a charge or they think that the standard of proof is too high for a criminal case. Remember, in criminal cases, you have to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil case, the standard is lower. And so you can sue them for actual damages, and hitting them in the pocketbook can sometimes be much more effective. And our point is that you can take this law, it already exists, it passed easily, bipartisan, and you just add, in addition to abortion rights, you say something like, or free speech rights. It's a very simple change, and it ought to be able to go through on that grounds rather easily. Now, as an example of how that would actually work in practice, or why this is very important, consider what happened last week. Some of you may be aware, there's a man named Zachary Chesser. I think his nom de guerre is Abu Talha al-Amriki. That's what he goes by. But at any rate, he pled guilty last week to a variety of crimes. He is the man who threatened South Park, the South Park episodes, back in April. You may recall there was an episode of South Park where they mocked or lampooned the fact that there's all this outrage at depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, and there was a website, revolutionmuslim.com, that said, hey, you producers of South Park, you better watch it because someone may wind up killing you. And it actually provided their name, their photos and their address and so forth, and essentially seemed like a solicitation to kill them. And Comedy Central, which distributes the show, was panicked, and they censored the episode, so they caved to the threat. Now, the man behind that threat was this Zachary Chesser, but he wasn't arrested, even though they knew that he was behind it, because if the NYPD said that we don't think it rises to the level of a threat. So legally, they recognized that it was a threat, but legally they didn't feel they could prove it. And it was perceived as such by Comedy Central, but again, there was no actual legal action against him to stop it. So what did he do? And this was not revealed until last week when court documents were filed by the prosecutors. But about a month later, he actually threatened Facebook users. What had happened was that there was a Facebook group started called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. And the point of this group was to say, they're trying to tell us, these extremists, that we shouldn't draw pictures of Muhammad. To stand up against them, we're going to put a whole group of people, and we're all going to draw Muhammad on the same day. And we're essentially going to water down the pool of targets so they can't target any single one of us. And so they started this Facebook group. Facebook, by the way, some of you may not be aware, it's a very popular social networking site. It's sort of an internet website where people put up their own personal profiles and they can all join together certain organizations or certain groups that stand for this or the other idea. And so there was this particular group on Everybody Draw Muhammad. It got thousands and thousands of people to join it. People were trying to stand up for free speech rights. And what this Chesser did is he went and he found the personal information, the personal contact information of the people who joined this group, and he handed it over to a jihadi website. And the U.S. attorney in the case said that even though Chesser is now behind bars, these people whose names were handed over, they're going to be at risk for years to come. And not only did he do that, but he also, you know, even by handing this over and threatening people, he caused people throughout the country to fear speaking out, even in jest, lest they be labeled enemies and possibly killed. So there's a very tremendous chilling effect that was put upon people by what Chesser did, even though they caught him. And he was finally arrested, though, not for making either of these two threats, but for the third thing he did, which was unrelated. And it had to do with traveling to Somalia to join an Al-Qaeda-related foreign terrorist organization. And it was only after they captured him for this third thing that they threw in the first two items. Oh, you threatened Facebook users and you threatened Comedy Central as part of the plea agreement. but they didn't originally charge him with it, and they certainly didn't charge him with it earlier, which had they done so, they might have prevented all this information from getting out and these people from having these lasting damage and having to look over their shoulder all the time. And the point I'm making here is if we had the law that we described, something like this FACE Act, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances, it would have allowed Chesser's first victims, the Comedy Central people, to sue him civilly for damages. And he'd have been wound up in court, and he'd have had to pay for a lawyer, and he'd have subpoenas to deal with and productions to deal with, and it probably would have deterred him from doing the same exact thing to the Facebook users that he tried to do to the South Park people, which is, you know, distribute their names and photos and addresses. And so he would have been distracted and deterred from causing this this lasting damage that he did. And so we think it's a very important tool to be able to have these civil damages provision. And we think the way to do it is to essentially make a minor change to existing federal law. I've run a bit over what I'd planned to do, and I apologize for that, but I think we should take now some questions, and I can elaborate on anything I've discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Huff. Ladies and gentlemen, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute and select it to ask a question. Once again, to ask a live question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our first question is from Mr. Larry Hochberg. Go ahead, please.
Very interesting presentation, Mr. Huff, and I appreciate it. My question is somewhat related. You're probably aware of the situation going on now in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, regarding the mosque that wants to build a new location in that town. And there's either a lawsuit or some very strong public action to prevent it. And I guess the question is the mosque being used for terrorist purposes, and are serious members of the mosque itself involved, either in the 9/11 or the renting of cars or whatever? How far? What's the line you cross on a fishing expedition versus a real threat to this system of government?
Well, it's a tough question. It's obviously going to be somewhat of a gray area, but I think the way to approach it really is to focus on transparency. And if there are legitimate questions or probable cause to believe that there is an issue, it is reasonable to request or compel the builders to provide information on where their funding is coming from. And as if you have evidence, as they do, that certain other mosques in the U.S. were funded by Saudis and so forth, and you had, for example, the textbooks being a major issue in schools and this foreign funding being used to further ideological purposes, and if you have examples of where this occurred with other buildings, the Islamic Society of Boston, some of you may be aware of that case from 2002 or 2003, where they were able to build a mosque. They got land from less than the market value from the city of Boston. The funding seemed to have ties to foreign people, foreign investors, not investors isn't the right word, but foreign governments that had agendas. And they tried to investigate it, and the ISB, the Islamic Society of Boston, turned around and it sued the people doing the investigation, which included prominent news organizations, Fox 25, which is the local affiliate, and the Boston Herald, the Boston Globe. I actually know the lawyer who defended the Boston Herald. But the point is that that was a legitimate fishing expedition, so to speak, and it was halted by the reverse of what you described, which is the threat by the Islamic builders against the people who were trying to do the investigation, saying you better stop and you're going to have to hire lawyers and so forth. And so my point is you have examples of where this sort of thing's happened before, and so I think it's reasonable to make a basic inquiry into what are the sources of the funding here. You essentially may have probable cause to believe that there might be something amiss, but I do agree that you have to be careful that you're not simply trying to use the law to slow down and essentially interfere with other people's religious rights as much as one might be leery of what they're doing.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mr. Craig Snyder. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Excellent presentation. I could listen to a lot more of that and look forward to learning more. The question I have for you is, if you were to pursue an initiative to establish a law or a statute, I'm not a lawyer, so forgive me if I'm botching the legal terms, but How could different organizations and individuals assist in this matter? What's required to get this thing done?
Well, the first thing you want to do really is identify some sponsors for the legislation and offer it on the floor of the House or the Senate, at which point it would be handed over to the Committee of Jurisdiction, the committee that handles it. It would probably be the Judiciary Committee in this case, or the Committee on Homeland Security, and they would then study it. But the number one step at this point really is to identify potential sponsors. Now, right now is a bit of a holding pattern. We've had some meetings on Capitol Hill, but because of the impending election and a lot of the uncertainty that surrounds it, people aren't really focused on it right now. So you'd have to wait to the next session. But the first thing to do would be for these organizations to all come together and say, you know, we support this, because that's something that the offices look to. And what kind of support does it have? Is it, and to the extent you could get a broad range of support, I think that, that would be better to style this as, for example, defending free speech more broadly rather than simply speech on Islam, even though that's the way we approach it. It might be better to bring in organizations that might otherwise be a little bit leery. For example, ACLU, of course, they have caused problems before for the types of things that we work on. But on the other hand, they could be a very powerful ally in terms of this particular item. So I think that what we want is for a number of organizations to get together and say, we can support this, and let's use our contacts to find and send letters to members in Capitol Hill to say this is something we ought to support. As for individuals who don't have specific connections to particular legislators, what can help there is our letters and phone calls, essentially, to offices. And you have to be careful because, as a nonprofit, we cannot. We have to be careful to the extent that we're encouraging people to lobby on behalf of specific legislation. We have a lot of leeway, but it gets a little bit tricky. But the point is that offices take calls, they keep tracks of the calls and the letters and so forth. And Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who is a prominent activist on women's issues in Islam, and I wrote an op-ed on this issue, which I think was linked in the invitation to this event in the LA Times. And so anyone could look at that and say, hey, this is a good idea, and then contact their congressman or their legislator, senator, and say, you know, have you seen this? This is something we'd, you know, like you to consider and to get some momentum behind it to get it sponsored, which I think is, again, the first step. So it's a long answer to a short question.
Well, that answers it. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Ms. Eva Kessner. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Yes, I'd like to know if you think that Juan Williams would have a case to sue NPR, and wouldn't it be important to do that just so that there isn't a chilling effect on journalists from expressing their opinions?
Well, we are very concerned about the Juan Williams situation. It's quite a stark example of this political correctness running amok. As far as the case, the better case would probably be Derek Fenton, who'd burned the Quran and was fired by the New Jersey Transit for expressing himself off-duty, and he was an employee of a government. Now, the question with NPR, the difficulty there is ordinarily the First Amendment rights run against the government, so you'd have to show government action. Now, it is National Public Radio, and they are supposedly funded by the government, but they claim we only get 2% of our funding from the government. And that's not really true. It's kind of a lie, because they get funded through, the national NPR gets funded through their affiliates, and their affiliates get money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So it's a little more complicated, and it's more money than just 2%. But you'd have to really dig into that to establish that what they're doing is actually sponsored by the state, and that's critical for Juan Williams to have a case. If you can establish that NPR is a government, essentially acting under color of law as a government, then he would have First Amendment rights against them, and he could say, you fired me for exercising my First Amendment rights, and he could possibly have a case, even because he was, I guess, somewhat off-duty, and they'd have to prove that what he was doing impaired their ability to function effectively, which I think would be very difficult to do since the context of his statements really is very, very mild. I do agree with you that something has to be done to prevent the chilling effect. I'm not sure if the lawsuit is perhaps the best thing. I think something else that could be done is, A, there's a lot of talk in Congress about trying to cut the funding for NPR, which even if it's only 2%, is, as I say, more than that, and that is not insignificant. Now, they've talked about that for years, so one would think that they haven't done it before, maybe they won't do it now, but if the Republican majority has come in, this is something that I know that Republicans have talked about for a while, and if they can't do that, one has to think there's not too much else they could do as far as their plans go. So hopefully it could actually happen. And I read on the Washington Post that NPR is scared about that. And the other thing that I think people ought to consider really is individual donations, withholding those for a little bit of time. I mean, I listen to NPR, and I know that they have these essentially biannual fundraising drives. And to the extent people give to that, I encourage people not to. And in fact, what the Legal Project did was we set up a Facebook page that encourages people not to donate to NPR until they apologize to Juan Williams and offer him his job back. Which reminds me, by the way, of another problem with the lawsuit. He'd have to show damage if he actually wanted to proceed with the lawsuit. And it would be difficult to do that because he got a very lucrative contract from Fox, I think $2 million or something like that. So even if he proved a violation of law, it would be difficult to show damage. But I think that going after their funding is probably a wiser strategy. But I totally agree with you that something has to be done because we really need to stop this political correctness run amok. And it's not just, you know, in terms of journalist reporting. You remember, I think it was last year, the military man who fired at Fort Hood massacred all those soldiers, and the subsequent investigation revealed that people saw that he was a crazy nut. They didn't want to say anything because they were afraid of being considered against Islam. So it's not just, you know, free speech rights or robust discussion of Islam. It's really people's lives are in danger because people don't want to be labeled as anti-Islam. So I do think we need to do something. Is that does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. There are no further questions. I will turn it back to you, Mr. Huff.
Okay, thank you. I know I ran a little bit over time. I just want to make a final closing remark and thank everybody for their attention. When I say we defend free speech rights, it's not just an abstract commitment to free speech, and it's not just about saving lives, for example, in the Fort Hood example I gave in answer to the last question. What we're really trying to do here is defend Western civilization. I hate to say that sometimes because it sounds very extravagant and grandiose, but really that's what it's about. Because if you think about what is the attitude, what is the purpose of the Islamists, what they're really trying to do is to establish Sharia law, their radical brand of Islamic law in society at large. And the first step in doing that is preventing people from speaking out and challenging their efforts to do it, from investigating Islam or speaking critically of it. That's really the main obstacle to it. So to the extent they're getting people through lawsuits and physical threats and firing people from their jobs, to the extent they're able to censor discussion of Islam, you're establishing a privileged status for this religion. Essentially, you can say whatever you want about Buddhism or Judaism or Christianity, but you can't touch Islam. They're giving it a privileged status, and that really is the first step to obtaining their goals. So it's really quite critical that we stand up to this, and I'm just very glad that so many of you took the time out of your busy schedules to listen to this presentation and care about these issues and support the cause. So thank you again. And my email is Huff, H-U-F-F, at ME Forum. If I did not adequately answer any questions or you have further ones that occur to you later, please email me. I'm very happy to answer any of them, speak on the phone. If you have any ideas about things you think we ought to be doing or avenues we ought to explore, again, very happy to discuss them. I also encourage you to check out our website, legal-project.org. We have periodic writings and articles giving further explanation of the things we've discussed and updates on various things we're doing. So thank you very, very much again for your attention. Have a great afternoon.